Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Miguel Delaney of The Independent, and Glenn Moore of World Soccer. Jurgen Klopp was paraphrasing Arrigo Sacchi when he called football the most important of the least important things in life. There's a lot to be said for that point of view, but is that enough in the current crisis? We're diving straight back into the Premier League in midweek. Steve Bruce triggered an overdue debate when he said that continuing the football season in current circumstances is morally questionable. Do you agree with him, Miguel?
I don't, I have to say. It would be morally questionable if there was scientific evidence that the playing and staging of football contributed to the worsening numbers, or that's where or players were in some way putting themselves in danger by playing, training or travelling. But all the scientific evidence indicates that's not the case. I have to say, to give Bruce his due, because I think you're absolutely right, it's a fair debate to start. But I also think it's, and we've heard this a little bit from people around the game, you know, there's been increasing newspaper columns about it. But I think it's an understandable emotional reaction to the situation around us, and almost a feeling that, oh, something has to be done. There's almost that. There's that kind of strange incongruence of, on one hand, we have these awful numbers of positive cases and deaths per day, and on the other hand, the kind of, you know, quote unquote normality of football taking place. But this should be a case for rational reasons, not emotional reasons. And I suppose to reassert the primary point, if football is not contributing to this crisis, and if it's safe to stage, then I don't see any moral issue there, and I do think it should continue. And then, of course, there are wider tangents connected to that, like, especially if, say, lockdown is enforced to an even stronger degree, the necessity of something like football as entertainment, which was a debate that came up in the summer and ended up actually being kind of a bit more moot because restrictions in general lessened the summer. Well, it might be even more essential now. But for me, the bottom line that really comes down here is that it's about the science. If football was contributing to these numbers or a danger in itself, I think the argument would be fair. But because it isn't, I don't see the reason to stop it.
Yeah, the scenes outside the Marine ground yesterday didn't really inspire confidence, but, you know, that was a policing issue, wasn't it? Glenn, if you look at the criteria for continuing, and I'm asking you also whether you agree with Miguel here, but if you do, what are the criteria that we should be using?
I do agree with Miguel, and for similar sort of reasons, but with one or two caveats. I mean, I think it is a situation that needs to be kept under review as things proceed, and particularly if there's more measures and lockdowns. I mean, obviously, lower down the league, they've had to stop anyway because they're not allowed to travel. I mean, Marine can't play league games, for example, even though they can play in the FA Cup. And in the women's game, there's very few teams that are still able to play. In terms of the caveats, I mean, one is the science. I mean, although obviously players tend to be younger and fitter, there have been some players, the two at Newcastle, one or two others who have suffered quite badly from the effects of catching COVID. I mean, they've not been hospitalised, in fact, as far as I'm aware, but there is an impact there. And obviously, we don't quite know what the situation is in terms of even if you've been tested regularly and even if you had it, whether you can still pass it on. So I would say one proviso should be, I mean, players don't want to play, are unhappy about it, they should be allowed to opt out. I mean, like in various industries, people being allowed not to go into the office, as it were. They should be allowed to opt out without any penalty. I know that football's not that sort of industry, really, but it certainly should be one taken into account. Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with the idea of vaccinating players, because that's taking away resources. But I don't see a problem at the moment. They're not taking away resources. They're managing their own testing. There's plenty of capacity for testing. They're managing their own, you know, sort of medical, internal medical healthcare as a general rule. So there's talk about maybe, you know, banning goal celebration, stuff like that. To be honest, I think if players are grappling each other at corners in close contact and travelling together at games and things, I don't really think that shaking hands at the end of a game or those sort of things are going to make an awful lot of difference. What I would think should be cracked down, and maybe it is time with it for the FA to really put their marker and the Premier League in conjunction, is the breaches that begin to crop up. Yeah, players doing stuff and being daft enough to post on social media. This is basically the men's and the women's game. I mean, I noticed the Rugby Football Union have said they're looking at, they basically warned their clubs that they are prepared to crack down, potentially 8-match ban for players, 10 points for the clubs. I mean, those are the sort of punishments that would really make an impact. I mean, fining players doesn't make any difference. I mean, they're earning enough money, their fines inconsequential. Missing matches makes a big impact, both the club and the player. And we're starting to see a certain amount of complacency, a certain amount of bubble behaviour creeping in, you know, untouchability in one or two areas. I mean, we're talking a very small minority, and most players have been absolutely very good in men's and women's games. But a small minority, of course, that creates a lot of bad publicity and obviously increases the risk of infection.
Yeah, let's look at the duty of care issue, if we could, please, Migs. You know, Steve Bruce makes the point that some of his players are still suffering after contracting the virus in November. Jurgen Klopp believes that Trent Alexander-Arnold has been suffering from the long-term effects of the disease. There are these warning signals still cropping up, aren't there?
I don't want to sound brutal here or callous, but I don't quite see how that's football, that is football's issue if they haven't contracted it from playing football. There is a more difficult question there. I mean, does society shut down while this is still a risk? And do all sectors shut down? Because this is the risk everyone faces. And it ultimately becomes about a threshold of whether we want to continue. And I think Glenn's raised a very good point there about the opt-out. I think that's a more nuanced and manageable option for situations like those that Klopp and Bruce raise.
If I might come in, from a particularly football point of view, I think there is an argument maybe for pausing League One, League Two. The players aren't tested as regularly. There's probably high levels of infection. And to be honest, there is flex in the calendar for League One and League Two to take a break. They haven't got the impending wall of the Euros turning up. Very few players at League One, League Two are involved in the Euros. In fact, pushing it back a bit might even help them financially, because I know they have to keep playing players, but it might be that some fans will be allowed in by the time they can later in the year. It might well be that they get more coverage as well with the Premier League if it finishes, and then you've got, say, a month, late May, early June, when you've only got League One and League Two playing. That might actually help them. So there may be an argument at that level, particularly because there's not so much testing going on there.
But we're confronted by the age-old problem here, aren't we, of institutionalised self-interest. It's absurd that, in terms of the practical issues of scheduling, you know, Jose Mourinho and Tottenham don't really know who, if anyone, they're going to be playing on Wednesday night, and we're now on Monday morning. That's madness. Do you think that whole problem, central problem, Migs, of essentially no one wants to give way in this? There's no room, apparently, for compromise in this whole structure of professional football. Isn't that the issue?
Oh, yeah, completely. And in fact, it's really, it's an evolution of an issue that the whole Project Big Picture debate brought up, which is the lack of, in English football in particular, the lack of any sort of central authority or main gatekeeper, that there's too many disparate interests, with the Premier League obviously being the most influential. And it means when it comes to discussions like the calendar, and now, look, to be fair, this isn't just English football's problem, this is one that was spread around Europe, which is why we're in the same situation we're in. When it comes to trying to create a calendar and what should be an adjusted calendar for an adjusted time, everyone has their argument about why they shouldn't cede their piece of the pie. And relevant to those arguments as well is the fact that no one wants to cede ground now, because it means potentially ceding ground in normal time or creating some sort of precedent. And even if you say, I mean, let's be fair, I know we might come on to this a little bit, but like the FA Cup at the weekend, situations like, I know the Chorley story was romantic for the supporters and great and all the rest of it, but ultimately, at a time of a pandemic, when the football calendar is under huge stress, we had a non-league team playing a bunch of kids in front of nobody just to fulfil fixtures. And the argument there, of course, is the FA Cup is so central to the FA's finances and the general running of a game. It has to be played. And obviously, of course, there's broadcasting contracts related to that. But that's a situation where every single competition we get to, everyone has that same argument. And there's no compromise around it, because I suppose ultimately of... I think Klopp was correct in this, because of inflexible contracts that were related to a pre-COVID time.
Yeah, I think the FA Cup is fine. I mean, the FA Cup have given a bit, the League Cup's given a little bit, the Premier League hasn't moved at all. I find it extraordinary that, as far as I'm aware, there was no planning done before the season started. What happens if we can't complete the programme? Or what might we do if it starts to look a bit dodgy? I mean, we've just come up to the halfway point, 19 games each, everyone played each other once. You could have had a situation whereby if it was looking a bit bad, there was a contingency that you split the league, top 10, bottom 10, and then you just play each other in that top 10, bottom 10, the reverse fixtures for the rest of the season. You shave about 8 matches off the season, then they do it in other countries. They do it in Scotland, they do it in South America. It's not a completely rogue idea. And I mean, the comp, you know, these couple of weeks will be really exciting. You know, will Arsenal get in the top 10, for example? So that could have been a contingency plan. Also, you know, the self-interest, I mean, if we get to a situation where they're struggling to complete the fixtures, it's going to be exactly like last year. All the teams that are going to get relegated will be saying we want to carry on. All the teams that are almost going to get relegated are saying let's stop, because self-interest takes over.
Yeah, as I said earlier on, it's an age-old problem that. You know, I want to speak up for the FA Cup, to be honest, because, you know, you talked to Migs about football being a distraction in pretty grim times. I thought there was something uplifting about the weekend. Okay, you know, I take all the, you know, the parameters of the problem. You've got, you know, the Villa kids on Friday night. But out of that, you've got Louis Barry, his goal, that interview. You've got Spurs, Alfie Devine. You know, Jack Pickbrook came up with a line of the weekend for me that Devine was born 2 months after the special one press conference by Mourinho, which blew my head off. I couldn't believe that. And you've got Crawley, Nick Cirulla, released by Spurs at 18 when he was involved in a car crash, tried to get his game back for a year. He scores in that game against Leeds, who, by the way, aren't everyone's second team, are they? You know, you've got a whole load of storylines there which actually really grip me.
I'd agree. I started the weekend thinking, I think the FA Cup really needs fans more than any. By the end of the weekend, I was watching every game that was on.
I think the individual stories are definitely gripping. But I would point out they're individual stories, not isolated individual stories. And because there's still a structural issue here, which hasn't gone away. And even those kind of individual stories really do still kind of pale against. Which is, I mean, and don't get me wrong, the romantic ideal of the FA Cup is brilliant. It's still one of the great things in football. The reality, however, it still runs up a contrast. And the reality right now is that because of what it's become, and because the big six still almost win it, almost by default, just through sheer force of numbers, it's basically, and this is especially true for most of the Premier League, most of the Championship, and even some of League One. And that is a lot of clubs. I should stress, a lot of clubs at a difficult time for the calendar, where it's basically a nuisance. Look at QPR against Fulham at the weekend. On the other side of the stories, these are clubs that basically know they're not going to win it. So they end up just putting in, you know, almost second teams, or it becomes almost kind of a semi-competitive game in the middle of a season like this. And if you got any, you basically have to go right down to the bottom of League One or even League Two, where the draw actually matters. And for a handful of clubs that may be in a Crawley situation or maybe in a Marine situation, but these are, you know, increasingly kind of isolated incidents. And it's still true to the third round, but the fourth round, that kind of novelty has gone off to a certain degree. So this is for a huge tranche of clubs. Yeah, the weekend's games were a nuisance, and we can't get away from that reality either. And that's still a lot of evidence. And we still have situations like, okay, not this season because of obvious circumstances, where, you know, there's so many stories of previous managers not being too bothered about getting knocked out of the FA Cup because it's a chance to bring the players to Dubai or wherever for a training camp so they're better set for the Premier League.
Yeah, but you could argue, I mean, I'd say look at the players who played at the weekend. I mean, Salah played, De Bruyne played, Chelsea played a strong side. All three teams in games that you'd expect them to win, they've got easier fielding weakened sides. And the FA Cup is six matches. It's not, the FA Cup is not the cause of the fixture problem. It's six matches maximum for anybody. The problem is the size of the Premier League, which should have been cut like it originally agreed it would do when it was first founded back in 1992-93.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but I also think the strength of the teams that both Liverpool and Chelsea played were not about the FA Cup. It was about their struggles in the Premier League. So once again, it's the pervasive influence of the Premier League, even there. Both teams needed wins to get back on track.
But isn't that the point of the whole exercise? You know, managers, some managers will narrow their priorities out of circumstance. Others will say, well, let's have a go at the Cup, because they see the broader element, especially outside, you know, what we still probably outdatedly refer to as the top four. So I think the Cup has a place in the calendar, and I really would take Glenn's point there about, you know, there are relatively few matches involved. The broader issue is the relationship between the Premier League and the FA. We're back to the old problem of basically English football has got a completely dysfunctional structure, aren't we?
Yeah, completely. And again, I said that this is just re-emphasised an issue that was raised in quite stark terms by Project Big Picture. There is no... English football has never been in greater need, especially in times of crisis, of some sort of independent, unifying body. And this is actually... It's an issue that's come up at kind of FIFA level and UEFA level a lot, where you have bodies that are kind of, that are supposed to be, or that are idealistically gatekeepers or safeguards of the game, who are also vested interests because they run competitions in the game. And those competitions are, while they're part of the same ecosystem, they almost are in competition themselves. So for example, the Champions League to a certain degree is in competition with the World Cup. Because they're competing for a size of the potential ad market and potential advertisers. I know that said that, I mean, on the surface sounds ludicrous, but it's the truth. And yet these, and both competitions are run by bodies that are supposed to, like, this is precisely why, up until an entente last year, that, and it was an entente that was brought on because of COVID, that FIFA wanted their own Club World Cup. Because it was, they saw how much money the Champions League was making, and were thinking, "Oh, we want a piece of that."
Yeah, well, I suppose European competition is an intractable problem, simply because it's absolutely cemented into the structure, isn't it? There's no way that anyone will challenge the primacy of those competitions. I think on another broader issue, what about international football and this summer's Euros?
Well, I mean, we've got friendlies now that are suddenly. Okay, they're still a little bit away yet, but they're on the horizon. We've got a round of fixtures in March. Sorry, they're not going to be friendly. To be fair, there's going to be some World Cup qualifiers. And if the attitude from October, November is maintained, they're not going to be moved. And that could be at a point where there is some backlog of fixtures. That's going to create a very interesting debate.
Yeah, some of those World Cup qualifiers, I mean, to be honest, look at the situation. They should have sorted that out in advance. You could have scrapped the whole March programme. You could have cut the World Cup qualifiers down to 13 groups of four teams, some pre-qualifiers to reduce 55 into 52. There's an argument that Russia shouldn't be there anyway because of the drug-taking ban. And then you can take March out and you can start the World Cup qualifiers in September, when hopefully things will be much, much improved. I mean, the other big issue with March is not just the fixture issue. It's all those countries travelling across Europe. I mean, there was a whole rash of infections after the last international round. And this is also going to crop up in the European games. I mean, the French are talking about banning clubs coming in. I mean, it's an issue rugby at the moment. None of our clubs are playing French teams in this round of the next European competition, but inevitably some might later on. This whole idea of travelling across Europe is going to get much, much more complicated.
Just on that, like, isn't the lack of foresight there, again, and this is something that's come up time and again since last March, basically, well, more last summer, but just it's like we've obviously been living with this situation for close to a year now, global pandemic. And a lot of those organisers in the game, it's almost like they're always planning for the best case scenario.
Well, Boris keeps telling him it's going to be over in a couple of weeks.
The nature of football administration is to put your fingers in your ear and sing a happy song and think everything is going to be okay.
Yeah, well, that's certainly been the case. Now, I suppose it doesn't help, to be fair, that a lot of these decisions have been made at what were relatively, I want to carefully choose my language here, because obviously the wider situation is so grim. But when it was, like, say in the summer, when numbers weren't quite as high and were in some cases considerably lower, that's when they made decisions about the calendar and the fixtures and the competitions. But again, as we just say, there should have been more foresight about that. But I suppose you can't detach yourself from the fact that the situation that the fixture list was made in influences the mindset around it. But again, it's why there should have been much more foresight, and there should have been much more flexibility to the calendar. And it is remarkable. And the thing with that as well is, it means even though we hope with the vaccinations and program and the influence of that, we return to a more normal calendar next season, a more normal situation in life as well. But because this season has been so intense, it will have a knock-on effect physically for some time, especially when next season is going to be already quite disrupted because of the 2022 World Cup on the horizon.
Yeah, I suppose. Well, let's look at women's football, which is an area of specialism for you, Glenn. You know, Emma Hayes at Chelsea has talked about a dark week for women's football. I think the honesty of Casey Stoney at Manchester United in admitting her mistakes was really refreshing. But the overall impression of the women's game at the moment is that it's in chaos.
Yeah, it has been a very bad week. I mean, I did a piece for The Eye on Saturday morning, and the website put a headline on it about the biggest crisis in the WSL short history. I remember looking at it and thinking, ooh, that's a bit strong. And I thought about it, and I think that's probably right. We've had a couple of clubs go bust, but always there's a sense that they were outliers. There's been a situation with restructuring that obviously caused a lot of pain for the clubs that were affected. But again, there was a sense that it sort of just accelerated what would have happened anyway. This is the first time I can recall, and others, that the game's really been at odds within itself, to the extent that players against players, coaches against coaches, administrators against teams, and fans very, very angry. There's always been this idea that women's football is this nice community where everyone likes each other and it's all well-behaved and they don't dive and they don't back-check the referees and so on. And it has been like that to an extent. But I've always felt that, you know, once you introduce money and the stakes get higher, that there's no obvious reason why women players should be any different to men players in terms of the way they view things, especially the ones who come up through academies and have lived in the sort of the bubble environment that the professional sportsmen tend to. I mean, rather than the ones who have had jobs outside the game and have played part-time and have a better appreciation. And now we do have this gap between the one or two of the players who are the older players who have done the hard yards in the early years when they were working two jobs and training at week and training in the evenings and stuff like that, who aren't too impressed with the younger ones who are going off to Dubai for alleged business meetings in breaks and some people coming back with infections and causing games to be off it. And there was a real sort of dissension within the game. It's you just hope that it will be eased soon, but it's not easy to see how quickly in this circumstance it will be.
Yeah, is the women's game mirroring the ills of the men's game in terms of, you know, elitism? You know, basically the WSL can be won by about four or five clubs, can't it?
Well, isn't that a case when basically, and this is something that's happened across Europe as well, when the super clubs and if I realise basically the merits in women's football, obviously, but that's always going to be a natural consequence because they're just going to ultimately have much more resources.
It is, but funnily enough, the amount of resources to be successful in women's football aren't that great. I mean, Lyon are massively dominant across Europe in women's football, yet they're by no means the biggest club in European football, I mean, compared to, you know, the bigger men's club, and yet they've been prepared to put resources in. We've got this interesting development in America where there are one or two independent clubs being formed. I mean, the LA one being the most obvious one, being Natalie Portman and, you know, some very high-profile backers. I mean, the amount of money required to be successful in women's football, I mean, the clubs are running at a loss of about £2 to £3 million. I mean, that's pretty small money in football terms. You could easily, you know, a moderate Premier League team, if it wanted to, could dominate the women's game by, instead of spending £10 million on a reserve midfielder from France, deciding, oh, we're going to spend £10 million in the women's game.
Yeah, that would make sense on a whole number of levels. You mentioned, you know, the academy bubble almost there, Glenn. Miggs, I just want to look at the almost some of the hidden aspects of the issue around COVID and disruption of football as we know it. There are hundreds of under-16 players out there who were told last month that they wouldn't be getting scholarships at the end of the season. What happens to them? Because their chances of getting another club are by definition, hugely reduced simply because academy football has been shut down.
Well, that's exactly it. And it was something I thought about at the very start of the pandemic, but in kind of, I have to say, in more, in wider terms almost, that, and especially at the situation where at the very start when it was almost, we're close to complete lockdown and we didn't know how long it was going to go on for. What, like, and I suppose I was thinking about it in quite basic terms, and like, how do footballers develop? It's basically, how do young footballers develop? It's basically by touching a ball a lot in competitive situations and playing with other people. Yet that is something that has been now denied to so many young players. And you don't even have to go to under-16s who are on the verge of professional contracts here. You can go right down to kind of the kids who are just being denied this stream of football. Now, obviously, there are bigger concerns in life, but it's an important social aspect. And now that's been cut off for a generation, and kind of a lot of kids have had a year's football denied to them. And as you say, the kids it most affects are those who would have been on the brink of contracts who now have nowhere to go. And it is just a game being put on hold. And I suppose we could be in a situation where we could be losing. And this I appreciate this is a very narrow view to have in the current situations, but it's the way some people would be thinking. We're losing potentially some very good footballers because they have no choice but to explore other avenues career-wise, because currently football can't offer them what their talent probably warrants. But it's difficult to see how you offer a solution to that, because it's such a unique and unprecedented situation.
Yeah, what about, Glenn, the your experience of grassroots football, you know, youth football? It seems to be a bit of a wasteland at the moment.
Well, can I just start with, you will know this better than me, Mike, but it strikes me actually that the lack of opportunity for 16-year-olds in the scholarships might actually be a blessing in disguise, because you know as well as I do that the tiny proportion of those players will ever make it as professionals. And the vast majority of their heads filled with dreams of stuff that will never happen and are kept on by clubs merely because for the one great player in their squad, they need 10 people to fill the rest of the team. A lot of these kids, it will probably be a blessing in disguise to be released at 16 before they get their careers completely and their heads completely turned. And the really, really good players, the clubs know who they are, they will still find a way of keeping those players in the system. So I don't think the academy is a massive problem in that respect. It might even help some kids. They will actually maybe concentrate on their studies a bit more rather than spend all the time thinking about a dream that will never happen. In terms of the grassroots, I mean, that's just a horror show. I mean, no one can play. Yeah, you can't play. Kids are just spending all the time online. I mean, maybe afterwards there'd be this pent-up demand to get out there in the parks and to play and stuff like that. But at the moment, the grass is growing. Leagues have been torn up for second season succession. Just, competitions aren't finishing. No one's playing. It's just an absolute horror show. But it's very hard to see. School sport going on. I mean, it's very hard to see a solution in the current pandemic, how you can avoid that. But it's a desperate situation at grassroots level.
Do you think this is an existential threat to the game?
No, because the game's huge, massively huge. I think it'd be more of a problem for some minor sports, perhaps, where people aren't playing. I mean, for football, may not be being played very much, but it's all over the television. It's one of the few sports that is all over the television. So I don't think in that respect. Cricket, to an extent, has got a bit lucky because we did get half a season last year, and by May, hopefully, we get a season. But that's been affected at schools level as well and at grassroots level. Rugby, of course, that's a winter season. I suspect there's a big problem. Rugby's not really my sport, but I suspect there is a big problem with rugby at grassroots level with players not playing. And bar takings are huge for a lot of rugby clubs in terms of turnover and stuff like that. So there might be more of an issue there.
I know you're a five-a-side warrior, Miggs. Have you been able to play much?
I suppose very personal experience here. Not really. And again, this is such a hollow frustration in the whole situation. But I think I've got out about 10, maybe 11 games since last September, and it feels like every time you get a bit of a run together, then football has stopped again. And again, I'm not complaining about that in any way. Obviously, you appreciate it has to happen, but I suppose it just reflects the frustrations of the situation we're in. Just when you feel like you're getting match fit again, because it's amazing. Like, even after a month without playing, you go back and mentally you always think, oh yeah, I can do what I was doing a month ago. Then you realise, oh, I am not fit here.
And then Delaney and match fitness, I don't really, they don't compute, do they?
After a few games, you know, I need a regular run of games. One of those players.
Well, I still play five aside despite my advancing years. We play indoors, though. We haven't played since March, and we won't be playing probably till next March because indoor halls have been blocked very early on, and we're playing a school, and obviously the school closed up quite quickly and don't rent the facilities out for big groups and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's going to be at least a year without playing. Imagine how unfit we'd all be.
Right. Not the most urgent problem, this one, either. What about the impact of all this on the transfer window, Migs?
I think... certainly this January, it will have the suppression effect that in England it didn't in the summer. I mean, it's actually incredible now. The transfer market in the summer was one of the busiest we've ever seen, and included huge net spend, which was absolutely remarkable. And you do wonder whether, say, we do get to some sort of situation where they have to shut down elite sport again, whether clubs will regret that. As of now, that isn't the case. But I do think there will be, given the situation got worse, given that's on the horizon, and just suppose the general nature of January, we will see a situation more like the rest of Europe where English clubs are a lot more hesitant, and I don't expect that much business at all to be done. I mean, I suppose look at to pick out an individual example, Spurs, who are one of the busiest teams in the summer, partly because of that, I don't expect them to do any business this January unless they sell, which seems unlikely. And I think that'll be the case across the board. And even clubs that are in need of some sort of business will be a little bit less or a little bit more hesitant to push the button.
Yeah, I suppose, well, Manchester United have spent, I think, an initial £37 million on Amad Diallo from Atalanta. Only 18. Is that foresight or rashness, Glenn?
Could you ask me in 5 years? We might know by then.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? I mean, it's an extraordinary sum of money to spend on a player who's played a handful of games. Obviously, yeah, I mean, he's very highly regarded. They've seen a lot of him, but there is so much that can go wrong between the ages of 18 and 21. So many players who were the next big thing who never quite turned out to be the next big thing. I mean, it is quite a gamble. It's quite a statement. But he might turn out to be unbelievable. He might be turning around in 5 years' time saying, cool, that was a bargain. Yeah. I mean, I assume he's not going to be the next Bebe. But we'll see. I mean, it's impossible to tell. United obviously see something and there are other clubs after him, but it is a gamble.
But that point actually raises what has become a really interesting shift in the transfer market. I mean, for most of the history of transfers in football, the biggest fees have usually gone for players. And logically enough, you'd think players in their prime are about 27, 28, precisely because they're in their prime and you're buying guaranteed quality. Yet these days, with more, I suppose, with some more financial intelligence from football and that, clubs now realise there's not the same value in buying someone that doesn't have that much of their career ahead of them because they're in their prime. And it's why the biggest transfer fees now usually go on potential in that regard. And it's why in Europe, and this has been a reason why the transfer market has been so suppressed as well, in Europe, so many of the biggest clubs have suddenly been left with these, and this is particularly true of Barcelona and Juventus, they've been left with these bloated squads where they have kind of players in their late 20s, early 30s on huge contracts that they can shift because no one wants to pay the money to get those players in or get those players out. And the players themselves obviously don't want to give up huge contracts. And it's created this kind of strange stasis in the market and is another factor into why increasingly clubs will spend the money on players who are 24 or younger rather than those in their prime. And so it's why I think situations like this, they're going to be less seen as gambles and more seen as kind of a logical way to do business. It's like buying stocks almost.
Yeah, because when you make a mistake, it's pretty visible, pretty obvious and pretty damning usually. West Ham, they managed to jettison Seb Haller to Ajax. A clear case of cutting their losses, Glenn?
Yes, I mean, funny enough, I saw one of his first games at Watford and he scored then. I mean, he looked like he might be a bit of a player. And I suspect there is a player in there, but you get these transfers where the fit doesn't quite work. The amount of turnover at West Ham obviously hasn't helped. And yeah, it's a good decision. You know, if you can get him off of the books, get some money, why not? And then look to bring in a player. I mean, David Moyes has made sufficient impact that he looks like a degree of permanency there, as much as you're ever going to have at West Ham, and therefore time to start building the team that he wants in his own image rather than trying to fashion what he can out of what he's been left with.
Yeah, when you're looking at West Ham bringing people in, Saar at Watford has been mentioned. Migs. When you look at that team, can we just dwell a little bit on David Moyes himself? You know, someone who was pretty much not quite derided, but certainly was disrespected over the last sort of year or so. He's actually proving himself again, isn't he?
Yeah, completely. And I have to say, I was one of those who was kind of, I wrote at the time, and think if you're a club with any sort of ambition or upwardly mobile, why, basically I couldn't see why you go for Moyes, who seemed like a manager out of step, whose football would be, I suppose, closer to something from 15 years ago in that kind of Benitez Mourinho era than the current trends. But he's done a very good job and he's left a few of us eating our words. And I mean, that's the thing. West Ham haven't just been kind of some functional team with a strong base who are going to go from there. There's been a bit more to them. They've caused big sides, big problems in games. Yeah, and I think it's absolutely to Moyes' credit.
Did you know Moyes is younger than Mourinho, for example?
Is he?
Yeah.
Well,
only by a few months, but he's slightly younger than Mourinho. That's what I mean. There's sort of, you sort of this image that he's been around for years, and he's actually younger than Mourinho.
Yeah, well, someone who has been around for years is Sam Allardyce. Has there ever been a more identikit signing than Rob Snodgrass to West Brom?
Especially given he's worked with him before, isn't he? Yeah. I suppose it's both a classic Allardyce move and a classic relegation battle move. And come on, we're in trouble. Get in someone we know and trust. The classic words, do a job.
Mm. That's not going to work, is it?
Right now, it feels like the quality of the squad is too low. I think that was all. I mean, to be fair, I think that was always the issue with West Brom getting promoted. And that, I don't think anyone predicted to stay up. I think everyone felt maybe one of those unfortunate situations where the squad was, you know, top quality Championship level, but not quite high enough Premier League level. And you do wonder then in that situation. And I mean, this almost comes back to the lack of foresight we talk about in the Premier League, and to a certain degree, the greed. And it almost feels like West Brom have got into the Premier League now, and they've taken the short-term decision to try and just stay there, when maybe the more prudent decision and better for the long term, and maybe for long term consistency in the Premier League, is that they did what Burnley did, say in 14-15, went up, got the experience and the revenue from going up, but accepted that this mightn't be, they might have to go back down. But then from going back down, use that experience, use the greater revenue to kind of consolidate the team in terms of quality and go straight back up again and in a much better position. But it feels like maybe
a lot of short-termism. A lot of short-termism at West Brom. I mean, they should have stuck with Darren Moore. I mean, I've seen Doncaster a few times actually the last couple of years, and they're one of the best teams in the lower division in terms of the way they play their football. And they're competing with teams with much bigger budgets at the top of that division. He wasn't doing a bad job there.
Mm. You mentioned Mourinho, Glenn. He's clearly made his decision on Delhi. There's a lot of talk about PSG involvement, obviously because of Pochettino. What credence do you give that?
Well, I mean, Migs would know better than me whether it's true or not, but it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you can't see him going to a mid-ranking Premier League side. That wouldn't necessarily work. I mean, he's going to feel he's better than that. There is a relationship with Pochettino. I suspect Ali would be attracted by the idea of playing for PSG. I mean, a proper big, genuine club. You know, and we know he's a very good player. He's currently having a bad time. I mean, he looked great last night, but it was against, obviously, part-timers. But it showed his attitude was right, which is really important. And, you know, I always thought that one of those moves that makes a lot of sense, to be honest.
Yeah, I would agree.
I mean, I want it, but if he does a Coutinho and ends up scoring against him in the Champions League, because they're not in the same competition, are they? I don't think so.
What about this? Look at the sort of the Premier League season so far, if we could, Migs, in terms of who's made the biggest strides forward. I'd probably put Southampton in that category. Is that the Hasenhüttl effect?
Oh, yeah, completely. And I think and it's why Chelsea are one of the clubs suddenly looking at if they do eventually dispense with Lampard. Hasenhüttl would be on the list, especially because they feel like they might have missed out on Pochettino in that regard, or well, certain people at the club do. But yeah, and I think that is the benefit. I went back on writing off Moyes just a few minutes ago, but I'm always going to go back on that. This is the benefit of really best practice in terms of the coaches you bring in, and Southampton really got ahead of once again. Just as they did with Pochettino, Southampton have really got ahead of the game there. And so far, they're one of the few clubs that have actually stayed resistant to what I would call the championshipification of the Premier League, where in the, this is, it's amazing how often this happened this season, and it's to a greater degree than any time I can remember since the 1990s, where the complexions of a club completely change within the spell of just three games. I haven't seen that this millennium in the Premier League, because basically because it's been in such a fixed place due to its finances. It's been kind of much more structurally solid in that regard. Yet this season, because of so many factors from the COVID situation, it's been so wildly unpredictable. But Southampton are one of the teams so far to stay resistant.
The one thing I would say about Southampton is that, I mean, I've got someone in my house who's very into these sorts of statistics. I mean, they are, on expected goals, massively overperforming. I think it's partly because Danny Ings has been sensational and Ward-Prowse is banging free kicks like no one. Those things tend to regress to the norm at some point. There's no sign of Sheffield United or Brighton ever scoring the goals that from the chances they're creating because they haven't got a striker. But for me, the most improved team is Villa by mile. I mean, no one's suggesting Dean Smith should be getting one of the top jobs, but I mean, he's and he's very happy at Villa, being a born and bred Villa fan, but he's done a sensational job there, where you think they were, you know, stayed up by the skin of their teeth last year. And a couple of years ago, when he first went in there, they were a basket case.
Mm. Doesn't look like they're going to play against Spurs, does it, on Wednesday? The day before, on Tuesday, Everton, another club, I think, galvanised by coaching, they're at Wolves on Tuesday. There are obviously huge vaulting ambitions there, Migs. Are they justified?
Not just yet. I think, especially when you look, I mean, did you know the average points of Everton over the last decade? Well, since 2013, I did a piece on this, and I kind of based it on the time since Ferguson retired, because that was such, I suppose, a juncture moment for the league. But in the 7 years since Ferguson retired, when there was a bit more of a vacuum, and there has been a bit more volatility in the league, as indicated by leaving Leicester winning in 2016, Everton's average point is 48-49, which is remarkable for a club that size. And the only manager so far to really bust that out is Roberto Martinez in one season. So I think Everton have to prove almost that they're really the next best club outside the big six before they could, at the moment, it's a sense, and I suppose this is natural when you have a manager like Ancelotti with his record, when you make a signing like James Rodriguez, and when you've had James Calvert, or sorry, Dominic Calvert-Lewin on such incredible form, that there's going to be optimism. But I think Everton have to prove a bit of a greater consistency before they indicate they're one of the clubs that were going to be regularly in the top six or competing for the Champions League places. It almost feels like a case of kind of running before they can walk in that regard. And like,
I think the issue of Everton...
Sorry?
I think the issue of Everton is that they have a very good first 11, but as soon as they have injuries, and recently they've had Coleman out, Digne out, Rodriguez out, Richarlison out, as soon as they have injuries, they haven't got the backup strength that other clubs have.
Mm. Have they got an identity, I suppose? I'm thinking of something like Burnley, for instance. They're back to the Burnley that we know and some of us love. They've got Manchester United at home on Tuesday. I've got a half a suspicion they might create this week's crisis at United. What do you think?
Yeah, and it's almost a year since they got that win at Old Trafford to create one of the biggest crises in the first place, and one of the crises that essentially was a huge influence in the club signing Bruno Fernandes, which has been the main shift at Manchester United in the last year. But yeah, I think they could cause real problems. And I suppose there's almost an element of, as you kind of alluded to there, not everyone will exactly be enamoured by Burnley's style. But there is something good about the fact they haven't just eventually petered out. Because I think that was an expectation this season, especially after the early results, that suddenly they'd hit that sort of plateau that does happen in the Premier League. I mean, just to throw another stat from a piece I've done, the average lifespan of a club in the Premier League outside those who've never been relegated, so what's that? There's about 6-7 clubs, including Everton actually, and also Manchester City since the takeover and that. But outside of this kind of established Premier League group, you might say, so basically everyone else, and it ends up amounting to about 40 clubs right across the four leagues, the average lifespan is 3.8 years. Because basically, no matter how well run you are, they eventually hit a plateau and come back down. And it looked like Burnley were going to be in that situation as well. They'd been well run, but they hit a plateau. But so far, Dyche looks like he's arrested it. And now we might have the benefit of kind of a takeover and another change in the club.
One thing that doesn't change is Manchester City's strength in depth and the intensity of their ambition. They're at home to Brighton on Wednesday in a BT Sport game. Glenn, you watched the Brighton game last night. They struggled manfully to overcome Newport. Against a team that's coming on very strong in the second half of the season, it's going to be pretty uncomfortable for them, isn't it?
You'd have thought so, though. They like to play the ball on the ground a bit, and Newport's pitch was quite tricky for a team that like to pass out from the back. But yes, I mean, Brighton will draw a bit of confidence from scraping through that, but City are beginning to look rather ominously good. Stones of the trick season, he's back to his best. They're looking solid at the back now. You know, Aguero is gradually getting bits and pieces more. You think he might have an impact towards the end of the season. They're still creating a lot of chances, and it's just a matter of question of whether they can convert the amount of chances they're creating. They're starting to convert a few more. Every time Foden plays, he looks like he's playing every week. I can see why he's been rested, you know, and used quite well, and I suspect we'll see the benefit of that over a long period of time. But your City are looking ominously good with their squad depth.
Yeah. What about you, Migs? When you look at City, do you see potential champions?
Oh, yes, very much so, I have to say. And that was not an opinion I had 2 months ago. there were a lot of murmurs coming out about how, you know, it was Pep's fifth season for the first time in his career. He'd spent so long, and a lot of the players were sick of the intensity. On the other side of that, to be fair, and I did write this around the Spurs game when they were defeated. Or no, sorry, it was that weekend. It was around that November period where someone close to City had basically told me that you shouldn't get too alarmed by the form out there, because all of this perceived flatness is because the club and particularly the kind of physical conditioning team are conscious of just how taxing this calendar is. So they're basically trying to kind of manage the load. And essentially it's to ensure that the team is at the right physical condition at the right times. At the time, I thought, I have to say, I didn't write this, but I thought it was that sounding like someone was trying to just put a positive spin on what was a bad spell for the club. Yet now it seems like it might well be true, because they really look ominous again. And maybe there's a part of it as well, essentially, where Guardiola, he kind of not slackened off, but kind of just got the club to stand, or the team to stand off a little bit early door, not race out of the traps in the way we've become accustomed to in English football over the last few seasons. Really, that was something that was put in place by Mourinho, where teams, you know, some of the best teams almost won the league in the first few weeks. Because of the calendar, that's not going to happen this season. And maybe Guardiola's feeling the benefit of that now, that they just, because the league has been so volatile, they just kind of stood off and stood still a little bit, and now are very well positioned.
Yeah, I just want to bring it all together if I could now, and almost like the theme of the day, really, the nature of the football calendar and how overcrowded it is. If one element of that calendar has to be sacrificed, what do you think it would be? Glenn, what do you think?
Well, I've mentioned a couple of possibilities. I mean, they should have maybe had a contingency for reducing the amount of games in the Premier League if it began to look like it. But, of course, it's a bit late to stop that now and suddenly say, oh, if you're 11th, you're in the relegation half. You know, rejoin the World Cup groups. They've not even started yet. So, in theory, you could do that. Again, I can't see it happening. It's very hard to see where the space might be. I suspect it may well become forced upon football authorities by governments in various countries simply stopping things happening, at which point it becomes very difficult. One thing that's obviously in grave danger is the Euros in the form that they're currently planned, if at all. But it's almost inconceivable to manage a pan-European competition, even if there's no fans allowed, with everyone crisscrossing Europe from country to country. I just cannot see that happening as planned. Quite how it happens, you know, who knows? Glad I'm not planning it.
What about you, Migs?
Yeah, I would completely agree with Glenn there. I mean, personally, there are so many elements of the calendar I think can and should be cut, but won't be cut because of so many of the considerations we've already spoken about, from contractual to just everyone wanting, or no one wanting to cede ground. And I think it will come down to governments. And I do actually wonder, I know Glenn mentioned it earlier, and he touched upon it there, whatever the Euros, whether European competition in danger purely because governments get more restrictive about who can cross their borders. And then UEFA has another decision to make, and whether we might have to see another kind of Champions League, Europa League in one country. So far, sport has been quite successful in getting dispensation. But it does feel a case of football isn't going to make these solutions itself. They're going to carry on hoping for the best case scenario all the time. And they might, and it might be the governments that force them into thinking about the worst case.
Yeah, one area perhaps who could squeeze a couple of weekend programmes back is if the Champions League and Europa League quarterfinals and semifinals were put together in a week at a neutral venue, a sort of version of last year. That would take out the clubs that are playing most. If you pack those games into like a midweek or and a weekend, it requires slight revision of domestic fixtures, but it would create some space in the calendar. And you could still end up, if necessary, if there's space, with a showpiece final in both competitions, or maybe you just tack the final on as well. But I think that's the most obvious area you could rearrange without too much complications.
Yeah, look, I know we're looking at making the best of a very bad job here. If I had to choose one expendable element of the calendar, I'd go for the European Championships. It's already been postponed for a year. As we've said, mass international travel won't be realistic this summer. Let's relaunch it in 2022 as a build-up to a Winter World Cup. And the wider problem, you know, I've sensed a growing apathy around international football, with the possible exception of Scotland, of course. The international breaks in October and November were absurd. What's the point of the break that's planned in March? Frankly, I wouldn't mind waiting another year for the Tartan Army to descend on Wembley. What about you? Please let me know. And in the meantime, thanks to Miguel and Glenn, and to you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.